CMS, we've seen 900% increases in diabetes in the United States in 50 years, 900%. And it's going to go up, but we don't know what to do about it. Well, how about examine your assumption? Are we wrong about what the cause is? If this was a legal case, and we have this crime being committed every country in the world, it's a very similar crime in a very similar way, who's the prime suspect? Who should we be targeting? Why should we be targeting? And the answer is sugar.
That's Gary Taubes, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Gary Taubes on sugar, how sweet it isn't. Sugar is the tobacco of the new millennium, backed by powerful lobbies, entrenched in our lives, and making some people very sick. There's growing evidence that sugar triggers chronic diseases such as diabetes that are likely to kill us or at least hasten our deaths. In the United States and Canada, about 30% of the population has diabetes. Obesity is at epidemic proportions. Heart disease is rising. Nearly 10% of children are thought to have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And sugar is a leading cause of these problems. It has permeated our diet, such as its uses as a preservative, as an additive in cigarettes, and the pervasiveness of high fructose corn syrup. Long-held assumptions about sugar are being re-examined. Some communities from Oakland to Boulder are now taxing sugary drinks. In terms of health, sugar can be very bitter. Our guest today is Gary Taubes. He's co-founder and senior scientific advisor of the Nutrition Science Initiative. He's an award-winning science and health journalist and author of The Case Against Sugar. His articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, and Esquire. He spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. And now, Gary Taubes.
Let me tell you a little bit about myself. The first thing you have to know is that I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nutritionist. I don't have a PhD. I am a journalist. I started my career as an investigative science journalist. I did my first two books about physicists and nuclear physicists who discovered non-existent phenomena and lived to regret it. As such, I was obsessed with how hard it is to do science right and how hard it is to get the right answer. And one line I quote in three of my books is from the Nobel laureate physicist Richard Feynman, who said, "The first principle of science is you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool." And in the early 90s, after my first two books, I had a lot of fans in the physics community, so they said to me, if you're interested in bad science or people who do it wrong, you should look at some of this stuff in public health because it's terrible. So I moved into public health reporting in the early 90s, and I found that my physicist friends had, if anything, underestimated the problem. And by the late 90s, I was moving into nutrition almost purely by chance. I stumbled into the nutrition field, and I did a series of two investigations, one for the journal Science on salt and high blood pressure, and you know, this idea that low salt, that salt causes our blood pressure to go up and hypertension. I spent 9 months on a single magazine article. I interviewed over 80 subjects. And I concluded that the evidence behind this idea that salt causes high blood pressure is terrible. And you would only really believe it if your preconception was so strong that you were convinced it was true before any of the studies were done. While I was doing that story, one of the worst scientists I'd ever had the pleasure to interview took credit not just for getting Americans to eat less salt, but to eat less fat. And one of my lessons from my early research was that bad scientists never get the right answer. So when I got off the phone with this guy, I called up my editor at Science. I said, when I'm done doing the salt story, I'm going to do a fat story. I have no idea what the story is. I was eating a low-fat diet like everyone else in America. But I know that if this guy was involved in any substantive way, there's a great story there. So I spent a year working on a single magazine article for Science, a single investigative piece. It was called The Soft Science of Fat. I interviewed about 140 subjects for one magazine article, and I concluded the evidence behind the low-fat dogma was as bad as it was for the low-salt dogma, and that nutritionists didn't have a clue what they were doing. This was followed about a year later with an infamous cover story for the New York Times Magazine called What If Fat Doesn't Make You Fat, in which I started looking at the science behind obesity and what makes us accumulate excess fat. That piece was probably the most controversial magazine article the New York Times ever ran. The cover was a porterhouse steak with a piece of butter on it. And the implication was that Robert Atkins, you know, Dr. Atkins' Diet Revolution, was right all along, okay, which was completely unacceptable to the medical community, but what the evidence seemed to support. So cover stories like that tend to get authors large book advances, which this one did, and it paid for 4 years of my life, so I could then do the book I'd always wanted to do about nutrition science. The book that came out of this was Good Calories, Bad Calories. When I went into this field, I thought I was going to sort of let the food police have it for telling us all this, giving us all this bad advice about what makes us sick and make us eat these horribly boring, low-fat, low-salt diets. And in the midst of doing more research on the subject than any human being had done until that time, I realized that there was a very compelling alternative hypothesis, which is the problem isn't the fat in the diet, it's the carbohydrates. So the grains and the starches and the sugars. And suddenly I'm writing books in which I am even more of the food police than the other food police. And now I can't go out to eat with anyone in my life without, like, we're at a restaurant and they want to order French fries and they're looking at me like, do you mind? Sad. So I wrote this book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. It's 500 pages. It's got 160 pages of endnotes and bibliography. Dense read. And after I wrote it, I got emails and letters from people saying, this book changed my life. Could you please write one that's readable? Like, could you write one that my father could read or my son could read? I got emails from doctors saying, could you write one that my patients could read? And I got emails from patients saying, could you write one that my doctors could read? So the result was in 2011, I published a book called Why Do We Get Fat? And What to Do About It. I had my say, it would have just been, why do we get fat? I don't like to give diet advice, but my editors insisted that if they were going to publish this book, I had to give some advice. I knew the book had succeeded when I got an email from a family friend saying, I was on a flight to the Caribbean and I read your book, therefore making it airplane reading. And then he said, I haven't had a carbohydrate in 3 months, I've lost 30 pounds, my blood pressure has dropped, I've never felt so healthy. The problem is I'm blaming obesity and heart disease and the chronic disease that associate with it on sugar and refined grains. And people would say to me, well, what about Southeast Asia? Here's a continent of billions of people who consume a lot of refined grains and don't have high levels of obesity and diabetes. So the obvious answer to that is this is a population that doesn't eat a lot of sugar. In fact, even though the sugar refining was kind of pioneered in China 2,000 years ago, in part because of the communist era, they never modernized their sugar refining processes. So by the middle of the late 20th century, they were consuming the amount of sugar we were consuming 200 years earlier. In Japan, which was always raised as an example, even back in the 1920s, when there were public health authorities arguing that sugar caused diabetes, a counterargument from Elliot Jocelyn, who was a leading diabetes clinician in America, was that, well, the Japanese eat a high-carb diet and they have very little of the diabetes. Jocelyn didn't realize that sugar and other carbohydrates were different. So the Japanese, as I learned in my research, in the 1960s consumed about as much sugar as we did in the 1860s. And they had the diabetes rates that were similar to what ours were in the 1860s. And along the way in this research, I had done some more articles for the journal Science about the mechanism of a condition called insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is when your cells of your body become resistant to the hormone insulin. It's the fundamental defect in type 2 diabetes, which is a common form that associates with obesity. And insulin resistance is believed by the researchers who study it to actually begin in the liver, in part with fat accumulation in the liver. And it associates with what's now called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is also epidemic in America, just like diabetes is. And as it turns out, a sugar molecule, or high fructose corn syrup, is half a molecule of glucose and half a molecule of fructose. It's the fructose that makes it sweet. Fructose is fruit sugar. It's what makes fruit sweet. But in fruit, you get it in very low doses. And when we refine sugar cane or sugar beets or corn into high fructose corn syrup, we basically take out everything but the glucose and the fructose, and then when we put it in sugary beverages, we make it very easy to consume. And the idea is this fructose gets dumped on your liver, and a lot of it gets converted to fat. And if it gets converted to fat, it's going to cause insulin resistance. So you basically have this scenario where there's a mechanism by which you would expect it to cause insulin resistance. And you would expect it, if it causes insulin resistance, to cause diabetes and obesity. And if it causes diabetes and obesity, you would expect it to at least increase the risk of all these chronic diseases that are associated with obesity and diabetes. So there's this whole cluster of chronic diseases. They're often referred to as diseases of Western life or diseases of Western lifestyles. Heart disease, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, gout, arthritis, half a dozen others, cavities. Okay, cavities are crucial. Dental caries, because back in the 1960s, people were saying since all these diseases cluster together, and the first signs, if you take a native population eating its traditional diet and you give it a Western diet, on the way to becoming obese and diabetic, the first thing you'll see is cavities occurring in the children. So doesn't it make sense that whatever it is that causes the cavities also causes the obesity and diabetes? Sort of Occam's razor, simplest possible hypothesis. And we know what's causing the cavities. It's sugar and white flour. So we have this conventional thinking in the field that the worst that can be said about sugar is it's empty calories. So it's absent vitamins and minerals, and it just adds calories to the diet. So when you consume sugary beverages, maybe you consume it over and above what you need from the rest of the diet, and that's what makes you fat. And to me, that's an excruciatingly naive way to look at some extraordinarily complex physiological phenomena, so I wanted to lay this out. And that's what I'm doing. So all my books, including my first two on physics and nuclear physics, were about good science and bad science. And one of the things I learned doing this book, or my first book on nutrition, is that prior to World War II, the very best scientific research in the world was done in Europe. Science was, in effect, a European invention. And medical science, all the fields of medical science that relate to obesity and diabetes were pioneered in Europe and in Germany and Austria. Genetics, metabolism, nutrition, endocrinology, the science of hormones and hormone-related diseases. And what I learned was that the German and Austrian researchers had a very different hypothesis of obesity than we do. Okay, so we think that obesity is caused by taking in more calories than you expend, right? This idea, it's energy imbalance. And I'm just curious, how many of you believe that to be true? You know, you eat too much and you're sedentary. Okay, good. I once gave a lecture on why we get fat at the Tufts School of Nutrition, which is the hotbed of the sort of anti-fat movement in America, that and the University of Washington here, two places that really don't like my work. And before the interview, I said, how many of you believe that obesity is an energy, how many of you, you know, an energy balance disorder that's caused by taking in more calories than you expend? And nobody raised their hand. And I said, well, then I don't have to give this lecture because I'm going to try to convince you it's fake. And apparently I had phrased it with a double negative, so. The counterargument, the Germans and Austrians had come to the conclusion that obesity is a hormonal defect. You know, back in the 1920s, obese people would say, well, it's hormones, and it was considered an excuse. Even back in the 1920s, before any hormone but insulin had been discovered, and people had no idea how hormones work in the human body, the medical community would say, well, this is an excuse for fat people to not eat in moderation like lean people do. And this idea built up through the 1960s that it was hammered on over and over again. You know, it can't be a hormonal defect. Fat people just don't have willpower like I do, is the implication. The Germans and Austrians said, clearly it's a hormonal defect. It's got to be a hormonal defect. I mean, look at it. Men and women fatten differently. That tells you that sex hormones are involved, right? It's got to be. Men and women go through puberty. The boys lose fat. The girls gain fat. The sex hormones, you know, it's... You get these localized accumulations of obesity. One of the most famous is something called steatopygia, which is a big fat, you know, I don't know how to forget that. I don't know how to describe that politically. Anyway, World War II comes along, the German and Austrian schools vanish. They evaporate. Some of these researchers flee to the United States, but they don't get jobs because nobody wants to hire these German Jewish researchers, and certainly not in Ivy League institutions, which actually had protocols in place so as not to be overrun by Jewish academicians and Jewish students. So, in fact, a lot of them ended up just moving west, and it's one of the reasons places like Washington and Berkeley, where I live, are such great universities, because they embrace these people. But this idea that obesity was a hormonal regulatory defect evaporated with the Second World War. And after the war, very well-meaning U.S. nutritionists and young doctors sort of recreated the science of obesity from scratch with no idea how to do science and no understanding of endocrinology or genetics or metabolism or even profoundly nutrition. And they ended up with this idea that it's just about eating too much. Gluttony and sloth. It was like a biblical theory of obesity. And in the 1960s, when researchers started to understand what it is that actually regulates the accumulation of fat in your fat cells, by that time we had already decided obesity was an eating disorder caused by taking in too many calories. And nobody cared what the endocrinologists were learning about this obesity. I was doing a BBC TV show. They were interviewing me, and the host of the BBC show was a geneticist who studies obesity at Cambridge University. He got a little angry at me because I kept asking him questions when he wanted to ask me questions. But one of the questions I asked him was, do you know what regulates fat accumulation in fat cells? And he said, well, we don't know that. And I said, no, you don't know that. Because you study genetics. But if you pick up an endocrinology textbook or a biochemistry textbook, it'll tell you, and it's primarily the hormone insulin, and it'll tell you what enzymes insulin upregulates and downregulates that work to pull fat into fat cells. Anyway, so this whole story ties back to sugar. If obesity is a hormonal regulatory defect, and if it's more or less controlled, as the endocrinology textbooks and the biochemistry textbook will tell you, by this hormone insulin, then whatever works to elevate insulin in your bloodstream is going to make you accumulate excess fat. And it happens to be sugar. Again, that's targeted in this condition in insulin resistance. And if you're insulin resistant, your pancreas has to pump out more insulin to make you accumulate fat, take up the high blood sugar in your body and deal with it. And so you've got basically a very strong chain of effects that would implicate whatever the cause of insulin resistance is in obesity, and if obesity, then diabetes, and if obesity, then diabetes. So again, that's the story I'm telling, and I think it's vitally important in doing it to understand the history. I'm also saying that in 2017, we've missed the story. So I'm making this argument that the nutrition community got it wrong, the obesity community got it wrong, despite the anti-sugar movement. The question is, why is this anti-sugar movement about sugar being empty calories that we consume in excess, whatever that means? Nobody ever says lung cancer is caused by smoking in excess, right? They say it's caused by smoking, but we'll blame obesity on consuming foods in excess. And the question is it just caused by consuming foods, just as smoking is caused by, lung cancer is caused by smoking. So what I had to do with this book is I had to explain why such a profoundly important hypothesis had been ignored. And something I argue time and again is the evidence is actually ambiguous. I'm speculating by saying sugar causes all these diseases. Why is it in 2017 I have to speculate? We haven't done the research necessary to nail it down. So the other part of the story is how the sugar industry worked in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to take what the nutritionists were giving them and make sure no one ever concluded that sugar was uniquely toxic. Not a short-term toxin like we're used to, like a chemical that might kill you if you inhale it for 3 weeks, but a long-term toxin that works over years and decades to create these chronic diseases, disorders that are so burdensome and will eventually shorten your life like no other. So much of what I do in this book is also talk about the history of the sugar industry, their public relations campaigns. They ran concerted campaigns in the 60s and 70s, first to fight back the challenge that artificial sweeteners presented in the 60s. And it's funny, people like to say it was a surreptitious campaign by the sugar industry, but I first realized this happened because I was reading a New York Times article. And an administrator in 1967, a vice president of the Sugar Association, took credit for spending almost $1 million to fund studies to demonstrate that cyclamates were carcinogenic. And to a New York Times reporter, he says, look, if some competitor can undersell you 10 cents to a dollar, wouldn't you throw a brickbat at him if you could? So it wasn't a surreptitious campaign, it was just capitalism at its best. Artificial sweeteners came on the market in the 1950s. By the 1960s, they were taking over the soda industry, and the sugar industry thought they had to fight it back. So they did. They funded studies, and they got cyclamates banned, and they almost got saccharin banned based on science that was almost unbelievably bad. In the 1970s, when a very influential British nutritionist named John Yudkin was claiming that sugar was deadly and that it was probably the cause of diabetes and heart disease, the sugar industry funded a campaign of researchers who believed that saturated fat was a problem. And they just had the whole country, the nutritionists and cardiologists in the United States had concluded that saturated fat was what caused heart disease, and if it's what caused heart disease, it probably caused diabetes. So all they had to do was pay the nutritionists to stand up and write what they really believed, and what they believed was that sugar was benign. And this report that was produced by the sugar industry, it had been designed part of a public relations campaign by a hotshot public relations firm in Chicago. And the report was called Sugar in the Diet of Man. It was about, 10 or 11 articles, a supplement in a journal, and they gave it to the FDA when the FDA had to decide whether or not sugar was safe or not. And the FDA read the report and said, clearly, these very influential nutritionists believe sugar is benign, so we will too. And one thing led to another. And the end result was that roughly they managed to, in effect, shut down sugar research in this country for about 30 years. In fact, by the mid-1980s, to say sugar might be harmful and to study it was to be accused of being a quack. So it wasn't just that the NIH wouldn't fund such studies, but it would actually ruin your reputation as a scientist if you claimed to do it. And what happened is some research was done anyway. For instance, there's one of the paradigm shifts I talk about in all my books is in the 1960s, we focused on the idea that we get heart disease because fat raises the cholesterol in our blood and our arteries clog up. We often use this sort of clogged pipe. And some people actually talk about artery clogging fats. How many of you believe that? Come on, be serious. This is Washington. You all have to be on low-fat diets, right? Let me rephrase this. How many of you eat skinless chicken breasts? Okay? And throw out the egg yolks. How many of you think butter is going to kill you? Okay, there are some fans in the audience. Anyway, This was the dogma, and the problem, and this was embraced by beginning with a Senate committee run by George McGovern in 1977 that wanted to get in the business of telling Americans how to get healthy, and then the USDA got involved, and then we had the dietary guidelines, and by 1984, the National Institutes of Health got involved, and they created the National Cholesterol Education Program, and then there was a report from the National Academy of Sciences, and it was followed by a report from Surgeon General's office. All of them saying dietary fat. The Surgeon General said that 2/3 of the deaths in America every year are caused by the fat content of our diet, and the evidence for it is stronger than it is for cigarettes and lung cancer, which was an insane statement. Because the evidence was virtually, I couldn't say non-existent, but completely uncompelling if you actually read the studies. So we had this idea that dietary fat raises your cholesterol, and that causes heart disease. But while we were proclaiming this idea and we were putting it forth and changing our dietary policies and creating this dogma and the belief that a low-fat diet's a healthy diet, the research continues. This is what science does. So researchers started saying, look, this insulin resistance thing, this begins in the 1950s also, seems to be crucial to heart disease. And there's a whole slew of metabolic disorders, things that start to go wrong when you get heart disease that cluster together. So it's not just high cholesterol. It's not clogging of your pipes. Your blood pressure goes up. Your LDL cholesterol may or may not go up, but your HDL cholesterol comes down. Something called triglycerides, blood fats, they go up. You start to become what's called glucose intolerant, which is the beginnings of diabetes is visible. Your waist size gets bigger. You're getting fatter. And your inflammatory molecules begin appearing. You begin to develop a state of inflammation. So there's like a dozen or two dozen phenomena you could identify that shows that this whole homeostatic disruption is going on that culminates with heart disease or diabetes or cancer, and it's all fundamentally linked to insulin resistance. So today, the CDC says 75 million Americans have this condition called metabolic syndrome, which is, for all intents and purposes, insulin resistance syndrome. And this is what's going to give them obesity and diabetes, if they get it, when they get it. It's a step on the way to obesity, it's a step on the way to diabetes, it's a step on the way to heart disease and cancer and Alzheimer's. And it's all linked to the carbohydrate content of the diet, and specifically sugars. And we ignored it because we were so focused on cholesterol. That's the message we wanted people to get. And the drug companies have drugs that help prevent heart disease, at least in some patients, statins. And the statins lower cholesterol. So the drug companies wanted to reinforce this message because they wanted people to buy their drugs. I mean, it's, again, capitalism at its best. But the real science, which was very powerful and very compelling, which all implicates sugar and carbohydrates, not fats, was ignored. And so what I've been trying to do as a journalist, and there are researchers out there and other journalists out there, and we're all fighting this issue of we look like quacks, but we're making progress. And what we're trying to convince people is that they shouldn't be avoiding the fat in the diet, they should be avoiding the carbohydrates, they should be avoiding the sugars. And we're trying to convince people that they don't get fat because they eat too much. I mean, think about it this way. If I was giving a talk on wealth, I might get a pretty good audience. And afterwards in the Q&A, somebody said to me, why is Bill Gates so rich? Or Jeff Bezos. And I said, well, it's because they make more money than they spend. You guys would leave, right? If I was giving a talk on climate change, which would probably get a pretty full house, and at the end somebody says, oh, Gary, why is the atmosphere heating up? And I said, because it's taking in more energy than it expends. And I looked at you like this was a serious answer, you'd think I was joking. But in obesity research, when somebody asks why you get fat or why he's fat or she's fat and I'm not, the answer is they take in more calories than they expend. And it's almost incomprehensibly naive. And it's so much the conventional wisdom. You show me a paper on obesity, I'll show you where that belief system is interwoven into the research and into that paper. My geneticist friend at Cambridge University, the BBC host, he's not studying the genetics of why people get fat. He's studying the genetics of, he thinks, why people eat too much or exercise too little.
You're listening to Gary Taubes, Sugar, How Sweet It Isn't. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So part of this goal is to get people to get rid of that energy balance idea. And the stakes are enormous, okay? Claude Bernard, the great French physiologist in 1865, said science is about explaining what we observe, okay? Fundamentally, that's what you're always doing in science, whether what you observe is a supernova or a gamma ray burst in a, you know, from the night sky, whether it's the way a frog behaves or a, you know, swallows mate, or you name it, anything. You know, why we get heart disease, why we get obesity, it's about explaining what we observe. The observation today that's so frightening is these obesity and diabetes epidemics worldwide. Every single population in the world, when they transition to a Western diet, from whatever they were eating baseline, so it doesn't matter whether they were Inuits living on caribou and seal meat, or Maasai in Africa living on the meat and milk and urine from the cattle they herd, or agrarian populations in the Himalayas, or Native Americans, or African Americans, any population, when they start eating Western diets, experiences these tremendous increases in obesity and diabetes. In October, the Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, gave a keynote address to the annual meeting of the National Academy of Sciences, and she said these epidemics of obesity and diabetes represent a slow-motion disaster worldwide. They're overwhelming healthcare systems. The estimated cost of obesity and diabetes in direct healthcare costs in the U.S. is $1 billion a day. If you look at indirect societal costs and you believe these estimates, it's $1 trillion a year. And Margaret Chan said that chances of public health organizations like the WHO reining these epidemics in, she said, preventing a, quote, bad situation from getting much worse is effectively zero. So think about that. The Director General of the World Health Organization is predicting complete failure in the future. And one of the things I would do if I was a journalist or in newspapers, I would have, I mean, imagine if this was HIV. In 1985, we understood that the HIV virus causes AIDS, but imagine after coming to that conclusion, 40 years later, 30 years later, AIDS prevalence, AIDS incidence had continued to go up, mortality from this disease had continued to go up. We would have task force and committees and think tanks and teams of researchers, we would be spending billions, if not trillions of dollars trying to understand what we don't understand about the disease. But in obesity and diabetes, we've had the same phenomena. You know, in the 1890s, the estimate was that roughly one out of every 3,000 patients in hospitals in the Eastern Coast, in Philadelphia and Boston and London and Paris, suffered from diabetes. It's one out of every 3,000. Today, if you go to VA hospitals, one out of four. Okay? One out of every 11 Americans in or out of hospitals has diabetes today. So there's been this tremendous explosion, and we have to understand what's causing it. You cannot stop an epidemic unless you understand the cause. You have to know what to remove, what to get out of the population, whether it's the HIV virus, so you recommend, you know, safe sex and contraceptives, and you design drugs that are that go after the virus. If it's a lung cancer epidemic, you have to know it's smoking, right? So you could tell people to stop smoking. In this country, with obesity and diabetes, we have the Director General of the WHO basically shrugging her shoulders and saying, yes, we've seen 900% increases in diabetes in the United States in 50 years, 900%, and it's going to go up, but we don't know what to do about it. Well, how about examine your assumptions? Are we wrong about what the cause is? If this was a legal case, and we have this crime being committed every country in the world, it's a very similar crime in a very similar way, who's the prime suspect? Who should we be targeting? Why should we be targeting? And the answer is sugar. Okay, thank you. I think I'll leave it at that.
So I understand the case against sugar. Is there a case against artificial sweeteners? Do they have a bad rap just because Big Sugar was on their case? If we completely replaced sugar with artificial sweeteners, would we be healthy or would we not be healthy?
Okay, well, that's the question. If we replace sugar with artificial sweeteners, will we be healthier? So, again, 1999, the food industry was making available 155 pounds of sugar to every man, woman, and child in the nation. And then you calculate how much artificial sweeteners, because they're much more intense, so you have a smaller dose to get the same sweetness, and then you ask the question, which is worse? So when the FDA banned cyclamates in 1971, which was the first successful artificial sweetener, they did so based on this rule that if you could show that sugar caused cancer in one laboratory animal, you had to ban it, you had to declare it not generally recognized as safe, and there were some lousy studies showing that cyclamates could cause bladder cancer in some rats at enormous doses. Some funny lines about you'd have to basically drown the rat in Diet Sprite in order to give it. Answer to that question is, I can't believe artificial sweeteners are worse. But the science doesn't exist to say for sure. So a lot of the research implicating artificial sweeteners comes from the science of epidemiology, observational studies. This was the field that I first started examining when I moved into public health. So in observational studies, the most famous is a nurse's health study at Harvard, or the Framingham Heart Study. You follow a population of people, you find out what they eat, you give them surveys, you follow them for 20 or 30 years, and you see what diseases they get, and you try to correlate the diseases with whatever it is they ate, and you come up with associations. And you've heard this phrase, association is not causality. So you can say that people who were healthier consumed less artificial sweeteners than people who didn't, and people who were leaner consumed less artificial sweeteners than people who were fatter. And the nutrition community, because they can't do any better, will say, well, this implies that artificial sweeteners makes people fatter. But the other likely scenario is people who have a tendency to gain weight are the ones who are going to try and avoid the calories and the sugars and the soda, and so are going to drink the diet sodas. So you don't know what the truth is. Those kinds of studies are the basis of this idea that artificial sweeteners cause metabolic disease like obesity and diabetes. When you actually do laboratory studies on humans, the evidence is very ambiguous and the studies are lacking in rigor. And they're often done on lean, healthy students. So if you're in a university setting, you want to do a study, you get lean, healthy students, and they might be able to tolerate sugar and or artificial sweeteners when middle-aged people predisposed to get fat can't. So I think the artificial sweeteners got a bad rap in the 60s and 70s. They were tainted with this sense that they're carcinogenic. I think that taint has stayed with it ever since, and people see them as a target. I find the science uncompelling, but it does not mean that they don't cause harm. The flip side is that there's at least one study suggesting, I forget what sweetener it is, might have been sucralose, influences our gut biota, and I don't know if that's meaningful, but the researchers would like to think it is, and there's a lot of smoke and I don't see any fire. But I think that artificial sweeteners are vitally important for a lot of people to get off sugar. It's just too much of a step to go cold turkey to drinking water. So I think they're valuable anyway, and I think my guess is that it's worth making the transition. They're certainly not worse than sugar. And another thing that I think of when I do these studies is I can find epidemics of obesity and diabetes in the literature in which artificial sweeteners clearly played no role at all. So when researchers today suggest that artificial sweeteners might cause obesity or diabetes, I say it kind of violates my sense of Occam's razor. In part because of the success of the sugar industry public relations campaigns in the 70s, the research that should have been done 30 and 40 years ago was never done. So we don't really know the truth. We know that they're not short-term toxins, which is what the FDA requires. We don't know that they're not long-term toxins.
I'm wondering if you can shed some light on the phenomenon where a person can binge on sugar to the point of nausea, and yet the brain says, give me more.
I suffer from it, if that helps. And the answer is no. I mean, again, because of this lacuna in the research, even in the U.S., there was one group studying the possibility that sugar's addictive at Princeton, and they weren't biochemists, and their hearts were in the right place, but I don't think they did good science. There's research in rats on sugar. There was a theory in the field of physiological psychology. So physiological psychology became neurobehavior research, merged, and it became genetic-dominated. But in the 70s or 80s, it begins with sort of Claude Bernard and Pavlov and a researcher named Cannon at Harvard who coined the term homeostasis. And the idea was that our fundamental behaviors are caused by physiological states. So you drink a beer, that's a behavior, but you drink the beer because you're thirsty, and the thirsty is a physiological state, and you're trying to replenish body fluids. And there's all kinds of experiments you could do in animals, like you could destroy the adrenal glands of a rat, and that rat now needs salt to survive. And without knowing it needs salt to survive, it will come to prefer the taste of salt water to fresh water. And then it'll drink salt water in order to keep living. And the theory that I found compelling is that the liver is monitoring the production of a molecule called ATP in liver cells. So ATP is the energy currency of our body. It's adenine triphosphate, and it breaks down to ADP, so three phosphate molecules. One of them gets used, you produce energy, you end up with two phosphate molecules. So the idea was, when we're producing a lot of ATP, it means we have a lot of, in our liver, it means we have a lot of fuel available, and that signal's sent many ways, primarily up through the vagus nerve, and it inhibits eating behavior. When we consume sugar, the fructose molecule, because I'm trying to understand that phenomena that you get hungrier when you start eating it. I mean, this is true to some extent. The French have a saying that the appetite begins with the meal. And if you think about it, you could do this as an experiment. Think about the number of times you sit down to a meal and you're not really hungry, and you start eating, and you actually get hungrier. And that's what an appetizer is. It's a food that's supposed to increase your appetite. So with sugar in particular, it requires more ATP to metabolize it than is produced. So it creates a diminishing of ATP in liver cells. So you consume it, even though it's in theory fueling the liver, it's actually depleting liver cells of ATP. And if my friend's theory is correct, that could explain a scenario by which, as you start eating it, you suddenly crave more of it, and you never get satiated. But not all people experience. Well, that's one of the things. I mean, I go out with my wife. So the things that inform my writing of the book, I have children. I have a problem controlling myself around sugar. I used to be a cigarette smoker, so I think I understand addiction on a very profound level. My wife, we go to dinner, she orders dessert. I don't, because I'm being virtuous, I don't eat sugar, right? She orders dessert, because she doesn't care about being virtuous, and she has two bites, and she pushes it away, and she's done. I'm having this mental conversation with her dessert now, you know. Go ahead, eat it, you know you want it. No, you don't eat sugar, it's bad for you, you're just going to crave it, because the more you eat, the more it goes back and forth. The longer it takes the waitress to clear her plate, the greater the chances come to 100% that first I'm going to have one bite, and then I'm going to just finish it. You know, like, give me that. I don't think anyone knows. I literally, and clearly we respond to sugar differently, you know?
Could it be that it doesn't pass the blood-brain barrier somehow?
I don't think so. But again, I think it's a peripheral effect first, you know? But again, it's whatever's happening, it happens instantaneously. I had a colleague at my not-for-profit who described the first taste of his daughter to an ice cream cone when she was 6 months old. And the effect is so instantaneous that it's hard to understand what signals are being sent so quickly, even when a child has never had it before.
Okay, sugar, I got that. Highly refined carbohydrates, which sort of turn into sugar fairly quickly, I get that. How about alcohol?
Also metabolized by the liver, also converted into fat. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is an interesting phenomenon because 20 years ago, if you were diagnosed with fatty liver disease, your doctor would assume, even if you told him you were a rabbi and had never had alcohol in your life, your doctor would assume you were lying because clearly it's caused by alcohol. Then what happened is it starts showing up in children. And it becomes clear that this disease is not always caused by alcohol. And Robert Lustig, who's the pediatric endocrinologist at UC San Francisco, who's sort of the most prominent proponent of the idea that sugar is toxic, the argument that I've been making, would say that they're metabolized the same way, effectively the same way. Biochemists, who I know, take issue with that.
As far as you're concerned, whether or not it's metabolized the same way as sugar is an open question.
Yeah, it's still an open question. I mean, again, I could probably find biochemists who could tell me for sure, but I know biochemists who take issue with that. The other thing, life is a bit tedious, and we do need to enjoy ourselves. You know, it's not just about living forever, it's about enjoying it on the way, so there's some balance.
Yeah, thank you for what you do, even if you did kind of ruin some of my pleasures. But one thing I'm curious about in your research, did you, presumably, having sugar once a year is better than having it every day, which is worse than having it every month, is there some... level at which,
I mean, clearly
you find it's not bad.
This is the thing, everyone's clearly different. I got an email from a guy who said, I'm 80 years old, I've been putting 3 teaspoons of sugar in my coffee every day for 60 years, I'm in perfect health, and your theory is full of... Clearly there are people who can tolerate it. Just like there's people who can, and this is where my smoking comes in. I mean, there are people who smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day and never get lung cancer and live to be 100. So clearly they can tolerate the cigarettes that they smoke, and there are people who can clearly consume enormous amounts of sugar, and it might even make them more vigorous. But the question is, when you start with the population, so imagine you have a population, whichever it is, it's a traditional, like, Native American population in the Washington area 200 years ago, and you give them sugar at 100 pounds a year, and then 200 years later, you've got some of them who are still very healthy, and it's a bell-shaped curve, and a lot of them are obese and diabetic, and it's the sugar. Now, how do you reverse it, and what level is healthy? And the problem is, I don't know. So another way to think about it is, clearly there's a level of smoking that people could do. Like, my wife could smoke 2 cigarettes a day, just like she can eat, 2 cigarettes a month. We actually have a pack of Marlboro somewhere in the house that we hope our children never find, because her friends come over, she can have a cigarette and smoke socially, and I can't. I have 1 cigarette. I'm going back to thinking about when I'm going to have the next, and to take over my life. So again, it's sort of a decision we're going to have to make as adults, both how much we want to consume, considering the balance between pleasure and pain. If I consume any, it's easier for me to eat none than to try and eat it in moderation. I think there's a lot of people like me. just as it's easier for me not to smoke cigarettes and to try to smoke them in moderation, it's easier for most alcoholics to not drink any alcohol than to try and drink in moderation. And other people can handle it. And there's just no way to say.
Any a related thing, any evidence that it's better if you're doing it, eating sugar as part of a meal with protein as opposed to by itself?
Yeah, probably. Matter? Again, I would say, I wonder in doing my research whether the real problem is sugary beverages because of the speed and the amount you consume. But again, there's no way to really tell.
So you seem to place the blame on sugar, but isn't it true that it's overconsumption that is the problem, which is the definition of gluttony?
It's funny, I'm staying at the Climpton Alexis Hotel, and the elevator has a quote from Mark Twain, and actually I photographed it, so I'm going to read it so I don't get it wrong. He said, "Too much of anything is bad, but too much good whiskey is barely enough." So one of my problems with this whole thing is as soon as you say excess sugar consumption or excess calories or excess fat, the word excess implies badness. It implies to... But what is the correct amount? This is the issue. It's sort of nobody says too many cigarettes cause lung cancer, even though clearly too many cigarettes cause lung cancer. We just say cigarettes cause lung cancer and the cause of lung cancer is cigarettes. My point is the word too much is a tautology. So there's clearly is a place, like I said, remember I said Japan didn't have in the 1960s, they had exceedingly low levels of obesity and diabetes, and they had the sugar consumption we had in the 1860s, which is about half of what we have today. So had we never gotten past, say, 40 pounds per capita in sugar availability, which who knows how much that made the industry makes available as consumed, but had we never gotten past that, we might still be a lean and healthy population. So that might be, you know, a sugary beverage once every other day or something, or a sweet as a treat, an ice cream as a treat, what it used to be before it became a common phenomenon. Then I could imagine that all our population would be healthy and obesity and diabetes would be rare diseases, rare disorders, conditions. But the point is we've now gotten to where we are today where 50% of the public is obese and or diabetic. So they might be healthier eating no sugar at all, not even fruits, which is a radical thing to say, but something I believe. So it's almost impossible. It's sort of the same question he was asking. How do we define too much? If the problem is caused by sugar, then it implies that there's a level in which it's so. Toxicologists say the dose makes the poison. So it implies that there's a dose that's safe, but we don't know what it is, and we can be confident that it's different for different people. It's like if you're lean and your sister's fat, your sister is over-consuming. I just have problems with the logic involved. And I can't, it draws me, my last chapter is called How Little is Still Too Much. And I talk about these, you know, logical loops we go in as soon as we try to define something like moderation, or the flip side of moderation is overconsumption. It's like Michael Pollan says, you know, famously, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. I think not too much is meaningless. Because there are people who weigh twice what you weigh and eat half what you eat. But they're by definition eating too much, right? Because they're fat. We don't say too much drinking causes liver cancer, we say alcohol causes liver cancer. It's true that you have to, there's a point that it's safe and a point that it's not, but we don't say that. It's only when it comes to food and sugar that we start talking about overconsumption and too much. Otherwise, it's tautological. Clearly, if something's bad for you, there's a level at which it becomes too much. Okay. Thank you.
That was Gary Taubes, Sugar, How Sweet It Isn't. He spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. Gary Taubes is co-founder and senior scientific advisor of the Nutrition Science Initiative. He's an award-winning science and health journalist and author of The Case Against Sugar. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Angela Davis, Arun Gupta, Richard Wolff, Ralph Nader, Naomi Klein, and Bill McKibben. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Gary Taubes, Sugar, How Sweet It Isn't, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Ed Mays recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.